the whole point of this book was to make our talk around marriage more humane and less damning to the people who can't figure it out yet or get divorced or are single. I mean, there's a way that our talk about all relationships and all realities is so unforgiving and so merciless.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and this week's episode of the podcast is a real special one for me. My guest today is somebody who I've been wanting to get onto one of my shows literally since I started podcasting 14 years ago. Her name is Heather Haverleski, and I first started reading her writing when she was a TV critic at Salon.com. I found her work so funny, witty, and acerbic, and it really was instrumental in helping me to find my own voice and shape what I think is possible with criticism. Heather has recently written a book called Foreverland on the divine tedium of marriage, and it's an incredible read. In the book, she writes about how she met, fell in love, and got married to her husband, Bill. An excerpt of the book was published in the New York Times. It was headlined, Marriage Requires Amnesia, with subheading, Do I Hate My Husband? Oh, for sure, yes, definitely. I'm going to read you an excerpt right now. Quote, I see Bill with a scorching clarity that pains me. This is why surviving a marriage requires turning down the volume on your spouse so you can barely hear what they're saying. You must do this not only so you don't overdose on the same stultifying words and phrases within the first year, but also so your spouse's various grunts and sneezes and snorts and throat clearings don't serve as a magic flute that causes you to wander out the front door and into the wilderness never to return. End quote. The book has attracted a lot of attention and a lot of backlash. Our society is not used to people speaking frankly about marriage. Think of the overwhelmingly vast majority of love stories we've consumed. Movies like Gone with the Wind or The Princess Bride or Titanic or You've Got Mail. Many of these stories end when the people either get together or die. But what you don't get to see is all the stuff in the middle, the difficulty, the heartbreak, the triumph, the beauty. These are the things that Heather brings to life so vividly in her book, Foreverland. In the conversation you're about to hear, we talk about Heather's writing career, what drove her to write this book, and what she makes of some of the reactions since the book's release. Before we begin, as usual, I want to thank all of my Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/DaveChen. You're the reason I can do this show. And if you want to sign up at patreon.com/DaveChen, you can get exclusive access to office hours, as well as bonus podcast episodes where I review TV and film, and also let you in a little bit on my thought process and what it's like to be a creator on the internet these days. So check all that out at patreon.com/DaveChen. And thanks to everyone who makes my work possible. Of course, it's very easy to support the show without any money whatsoever. All you got to do is leave a review at Apple Podcasts. Or if you enjoyed this conversation, share about it on social media. It would mean a lot to me if you did so. All right, let's get to the conversation. Heather Haverleski writes the Ask Polly advice column on Substack. She's the author of books including How to Be a Person in the World and What If This Were Enough? Her work has appeared at The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and NPR's All Things Considered, among other outlets. Her newest book, Foreverland, on the Divine Tedium of Marriage, is available wherever most books are sold. Here's our conversation, and stick around afterwards for our weekly recommendations. Heather Haverleski, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, David. It's nice to be here.
So I want to talk about the book, Foreverland, but before we get to it, I wanted to ask you about some aspects of the rest of your career. You were one of the first TV critics I ever read on the internet, and in many ways you inspired
me to do
TV commentary, and I'm curious, like, what made you choose that profession? Because you did that for many years, right?
Yeah. I didn't watch a lot of TV when I lived in San Francisco in the beginning of my 20s. And then I moved to, and I used to make fun of my brother who lived in LA because he watched so much TV. And then I moved to LA and I started watching a ton of TV. I think it might have at the time been just an LA thing. It's hard to separate, you know, your own life from larger trends that are happening in the outside world because, it was right around 97 that I moved. And then in about 99, I really started watching a lot of TV. And by 2003, my good friend Karina Chicano was the TV critic at Salon. And she would call me and say, ugh, I'm so tired of covering TV. I hate being a TV critic. I mean, I shouldn't even out her this way. I think she'd probably be okay with it. She's a great writer, but she was just, I mean, you know, being a critic, there are times when it just is not working for you at all. I went through the same thing. So, but anyway, she was the TV critic at Salon. And I used to say to her, my God, I want your job. Like the second you leave your job, you got to give your job to me somehow. Tell them to hire me. Because she, the way that she wrote about TV was so funny. It was right around the time of Television Without Pity. I mean, this was kind of a larger trend, but I feel like Karina was one of the first people to really dive right into TV and write about the funny things instead of taking TV too seriously. So when she left for Entertainment Weekly, she recommended me. I was already freelancing for Salon at the time, and they hired me as their TV critic. And then I was really watching a lot of TV, but I wasn't that into TV for that long before I was suddenly watching everything and writing about it. And it was the golden age of TV, actually. It was it was really a good time for TV. You had The Sopranos, 6 Feet Under, The Shield, I mean, The Wire, just greatness everywhere you turned.
It was great. It was a great job. It was great times. Do you have any thoughts on what makes for a good TV recap? Like how you approach doing that?
Well, I wrote some recaps and some reviews. And then I mostly reviewed TV through my column, which was like three different short reviews with a lead that was sort of strange about culture at large. As far as recaps go, in the beginning, when not everyone under the sun was recapping TV, because there was a time when, you know, it became difficult to think about even writing a recap, because the second your recap hit, you'd notice, you know, 50 other recaps of the same thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's exactly there now, but that was the sensation of just like, why am I herding in and doing the same thing that 50 other people are already doing? But in the beginning days, I really looked for what is the emotional center of this episode? Like, what are we, you know, it's like trying to unpack what the creator is trying to do with this particular episode. Since you're only writing about one episode that just ended and you're writing it and then it goes up the next morning. And I think this is what makes writing about TV in some ways a lot more interesting than writing about movies, or at least writing about your average movie, because an episode is its own little universe and it can be all kinds of crazy things. There were episodes of Mad Men that were just, God, what happened? There was one where a guy got his foot mowed off by a lawnmower in the office. And, you know, you would just be reeling after an episode just saying like, what did that mean? What did that even mean? So part of the fun, especially with Mad Men, and Mad Men was like one of the most, but that was one of the most fun shows to recap. Part of the fun was just trying to figure out what the message of the episode was. And with Mad Men, you know, it was always something like, something about capitalism.
Something about, you know, capitalism and toxic masculinity, I think.
Yeah, but toxic masculinity and longing, you know, for a life that actually feels real and genuine and not like a advertisement for somebody else's life.
It's also cool that, you know, with TV, there's like kind of a synchronized viewing, way less so now in the streaming era, but, you know, back then, everyone would watch the episode at the same time, and then the next morning, we'd read Heather's recap on Salon or something like that. So,
good old days. I mean, actually thinking about trying to decode it, it made you feel like you were extremely smart, right? Simply because you were sitting down. You know, everyone else.
You're like, I'm putting more thought into this than anyone else right now, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Like everybody else had just had a beer and gone to bed, and you were like, No, what the lawnmower symbolized, you know, the industrial
revolution. The lawnmower is
revolution.
The unpredictability of the future. Is what's happening, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you made one of the most interesting transitions I can think of for a writer. You transitioned from writing about TV to being an advice columnist.
Yeah.
And how did that work? Why did you decide to make that transition?
Well, in 2010, I left Salon in order to go to The Daily, which was this Rupert Murdoch iPad startup.
I remember that, yeah.
And why did I do that is a very big question. I had associations with startup, having come from the dot-com era, and my first job was at Suck, and we were one of the first webzines. So it was sort of like, I want that startup energy. I want to be, in the room where it happens, where it's all, being figured out and we're inventing things. And I imagined myself like writing cartoons again. And, I sort of would talk to my boss and say, I could do anything, right? I could, and he'd sort of say, yeah, sure. Review food. I don't care. You're the critic at large. You can do whatever you want. So I immediately thought, I'm going to see movies. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to see, I'll do a little TV. I'll write about music. And immediately what I learned in LA was reviewing movies means from where I lived in LA, driving an hour and a half, sitting in a screening room, driving it an hour and a half back, and then writing about something that was like essentially a haiku. Like it's, especially in particularly in like, February and March, when the movies are the worst movies that you will ever see in your life.
They're
right?
Very bad.
Because
yeah.
It's not during this, Oscar season. It's the throwaway movies. So I went to go see, Romeo and Juliet.
Incredible. Yeah.
I mean, sad. So I did not like being a TV, a movie critic at all. And I didn't like writing for that particular startup at all. And it was just chaos.
You said you're writing like a haiku because the space constraints were so small, right?
No, because the movie itself is like a haiku because movies that aren't incredible, movies that aren't breaking the mold or aren't telling a really thoughtful story are just often, they're just replicating a genre of experience. They're taking a shape that you've seen before. You've already had this. You've already eaten this cheeseburger is basically the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you see, I'm trying to remember.
If you see like a Fast and Furious movie,
I don't even want to give you like the the obvious things like a Marvel movie. I want to say like, something like there's a demon priest and, cause that's the kind of February movie, like, child killer, kind of like the hand that rocks the cradle, like Rebecca, is it Rebecca De Mornay?
Yes, I think that's right.
Things like, where, oh God, he's evil. Not even horror. Like Romeo and Juliet is a good example. It's like, oh yeah, it's Elton John songs, I think, with garden gnomes. I mean, that's all you know. And you go and it's exactly like that. You're like, bad jokes. What's another great example of one that I had to see? I just struggled to write. Okay, I remember a movie I saw. I saw a movie that was Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston pretending on camera that Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston could fall in love. Like, sure, they were playing characters, but it was Adam Sandler and it was Jennifer Aniston. And both of those actors kind of play themselves a little bit, like, especially in a, you guys are in a romantic comedy. At first you just drive each other crazy and then finally you fall in love. At every second of it, you're just like, of course, Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler are driving each other crazy. And then it's like, they're not in love. Ooh, look at them trying to kiss. This is disgusting. And then what do you write about that? It's almost funny, but it's not, it's just, not interesting to write about. It's hard to write about it. And there's no meaning, right? Everything that you could find in an episode of Mad Men, you cannot find in Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler. All you can find there is someone tried to make some money by putting this Ken doll and this Barbie doll next to each other, just choosing these two people and, oh, we'll say the rom-com things to each other. It was a bit really terrible.
I think you're referring to the 2011 film Just Go With It, is my guess. Right?
I think that, yes, 2011, right.
Which was not the last Jennifer Aniston, Adam Sandler collab.
It wasn't?
They also made Murder Mystery on Netflix as well.
Oh, God.
So they're still at it. They're still at it.
I guess they get along if they did more than one vehicle together.
Yeah. But anyway, you found it to be staring at Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler was like staring into the void, it sounds like.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, every year there are about how many good movies are there every year? You know better than I do. I mean, if you're gonna review art films, sure, there are probably a ton. But if you're just talking about like things that are distributed nationwide.
Yeah, I mean, you know, mass market, four quadrant blockbuster movies that are really legitimately artistically good. Not that many, you know, a handful per year.
Maybe 10 to 15?
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Like one a month, maybe?
Yep.
But even when you look at the Best Picture nominees, often there's one that you say, what's that doing there? Right?
Definitely.
Like,
definitely.
Really? There are honestly only four good movies this year? Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, let's see. What was I supposed to get to? Oh, yeah.
Becoming
an advice columnist. Sorry, I got way late. I'm kind of playing to my audience of one here, David. I'm like, I know you like movies, so let's talk about...
Yes, it's okay, though. You take wherever the spirit leads you in this conversation. So.
Okay. All right. So how did I end up writing advice? Basically, I quit that job because an editor from New York Times Magazine approached me and said, we want you to do these cultural essays for the middle of the magazine, and we're going to pay you really well. And I was like, great, I quit. You know, how many times a year can I do it? And he's like, you know, 8 times maybe. I'm like, excellent. I can live off that and just send you brilliant stuff. And I'm in the New York Times Magazine, and what could be better than that? I'll write at a pace where I can control. My quality level will be high, you know. So I started to write these riffs. And they were really fun to write. But of course, the second you have, a feature in the middle of the New York Times Magazine with a little cartoon, they were half personal, half cultural essays, which was my favorite thing of all time to write at that point. So I spent all my time trying to write these things and trying to make them brilliant, you know, and trying to cobble together like, I'll write about, let's see, Iris Owens and Entourage. I'll write about, you know, Jaws and, you know, something else. So I cobbled together these things and they were good. But my editor had a million different people sending him great stuff. And so I really only got into the magazine. I think my best year, I maybe did 8 or 9 of them. But I was, you know, in my house trying to make a living. And I started to get depressed and I was sinking into debt. And I was like, I need to go back to writing something every week. And it can't be based on any artifact. I don't want to review someone else's thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to, you know, have fun writing the stuff that I like to write. Now, what do I like to write? And then I was like, well, you know, on my blog, I give people advice. I could write an advice column. And so my idea was to write. And honestly, this came up on one day. I was sitting in my office and I was thinking, what am I going to write for the All? The All is the place I want to write. They're like the real creative startup place that I was imagining when I joined the Daily, and they're interesting and they're the cool people. I want to write for them. What can I write for them? And I had written like some freelance humor pieces for them. But I sent Corey Sika an email and I just said, I should write an advice column for you for the All. Just pay me like $150, just enough so that my husband doesn't spit on the floor every time he hears the word All. And he wrote back and just wrote, done. I mean, I didn't even send him a sample.
Wow. You manifested it and it happened.
Yeah. And then he actually talked me through like, what is your name going to be? You know, I hadn't even thought about it. I was like, mm-hmm. Let's see. Polyester was my pen name. It sucked. So anyway, I started writing this column thinking this will just keep me occupied. You know, I'll write it once a week and I'll just have a deadline once a week. So I'll feel like I have a job because in between waiting for my editor to get back to me. So I started writing these things and they were supposed to be like snarky and slightly cynical and funny. And soon they just quickly, very quickly expanded into these gigantic 3,000 word, 4,000 word answers. And they became these crazy. I mean, it's like when I first started down the road of advice, I just had too much to say. And so I would just say everything. And Corey, either to his credit or to his discredit, didn't make many edits and just said, yeah, great, and threw it up. And people liked it. People responded to it.
And you continue to write that column to this day, right?
Yeah, I was writing it for... So the cut came and offered me money to bring it to New York Magazine. And so I did that for in 2014. I started at the All in 2012. And then in last year, I moved from the cut to Substack. So now it's my newsletter. And I think that I'm in a stage where I need to reinvent it a little. It needs to get a little more interesting. That was my intention when I moved to the Substack, but I'm thinking of throwing in like a layer of book related content, not necessarily like here's a review, but more like here's a model of how to live in the world, extrapolated, pulled from this book. So I'm moving back to the artifact, I think. Just as a means of inspiration.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, I am a huge fan of the column. I've read many, many versions of it and have found several versions of it inspiring. I'll link to it in the show notes. People should subscribe to that newsletter.
Oh, thank you.
Let's talk about the book. Let's talk about Foreverland on the divine tedium of marriage. I usually begin these conversations by asking this question: why this book and why now?
I knew I wanted to write. I was ready to write something personal after How to Be a Person in the World, my second book, and What If This Were Enough, my book of kind of culture essays. At first, I thought I'll just write like a series of essays about kids and family. But I wasn't completely comfortable with that just because my kids are 12 and 15 now, and I just didn't want to write that much about them and then thereby, you know, saying things about them out in the world was not my thing. I mean, it's kind of ironic because I've been criticized for dragging my husband and flogging him in the public square, but I'm very protective of my kids and don't really want to reveal details about them. So I had loosely an idea of themed essays around family. And then I got on the phone with an editor and I said, and he said, what's the angle? And I was in this airport about to go to Australia with my family. And I said, the angle, yeah, good question. The angle is the marriage. The marriage is what's, that's the center of the book. It's going to be about my marriage, you know? And he was like, oh, that sounds kind of interesting. And then I got off the phone and I said, what did I just try to sell? Like, do I really want to write a book about my marriage? And then I talked to another editor and I said, yeah, the marriage, you know, I know how to write about marriage. I've written a few things about, I've written like, you know, two things about marriage that were great. And I'm pretty sure I can write a whole book about marriage. But the original idea was just essays on the theme of marriage assembled into a book loosely. And then as I started, then I sold the book and then I started to write the book. And then COVID happened, all kinds of things happened while I was writing the book. And almost immediately though, after I started writing the book, I started feeling like, why in the world did I sell a book about my marriage? Like who wants to do this? How could anyone read a whole book about someone's marriage? And then the more I wrote the book, the more I felt like there's so much here, and actually I don't want to include the essay about my uncle, and I don't want to include the essay about, I was going to write an essay about Stardew Valley, that game, which I love. I just want to write about, this is a chronological book about my marriage. It's actually going to start at the beginning and have an end, and it's going to, once I wrote the whole book, it was like, I want this book to feel suspenseful and I want it to feel exciting. And I don't want anything that drags in there. And I want it to be funny. And anything that's not funny, I need to go back in and see if I can make it a little funny. and anything that's, you know, and then it sort of becomes, am I being true to my, you know, am I really showing who I am? Am I trying to protect myself? Am I being true to what my marriage is? Can I, am I bullshitting people? You know, like you naturally as a writer have these times where you're just like, oh God, I'm just, you think you're writing something good and then you read it and you're like, I'm just bullshitting people here. Like, this isn't real. I need to go back in and be more honest about what's going on. So I edited this book so much to get it to where I wanted it, and also to get it to where it was, it felt reflective of a real marriage, where you understood what the marriage was made of and how Bill, my husband, and I got along. And so that was my intention, but it took a long time and it was much more of a struggle than I thought. And the results are much better than I actually expected them to be. Like, I don't think I set out to write a book this good, actually. Like, it's a funny, fun book to read in a way that I don't think I've pulled off before. So it paid off.
I'll just say as somebody who has read several of your books, this is my favorite one of the books.
And oh, good.
I think many of the aspects that you just identified come through. I think there is like suspense, you know, there is this kind of propulsive energy in the book because of the fact that it's kind of told in chronological order, and it feels like you're really welcoming us into your marriage in a very intimate way. Based on what I've read in the book and what I've seen you share online, I feel like there is part of the purpose of the book is to, in some ways, correct or put in a different light the ways we talk about marriage and how it's portrayed in public and in pop culture. Is that accurate? Was that at all part of like what you're trying to accomplish? And if so, like, what do you find lacking about how we talk about marriage in general?
Well, first of all, we don't talk about marriage that much. We talk about falling in love. We talk about what traits will make your perfect lover, and how can you find the person with the right combination of features and special features, and, you know, what kind of engine do you want to drive? You know, like we shop for a person. And then once you buy the right person, I mean, you're supposed to keep that person forever and not notice when the person's falling apart and not notice when the person is not meeting your needs and you're not meeting their needs. It's just, you're supposed to find the perfect person and then things will be perfect forever, happily ever after, no work needed. You better be happy or you're a failure. So the books I was reading about marriage for a little while, I just kept kind of feeling like this is not the books that were actually about marriage, right? Not just about love. I read a few books about marriage and I thought, I still don't understand. I'd read a whole book and I'd say, I still don't understand who these people are. Like, I don't understand how they get along. I don't know if they fight or not. I can't tell if they love each other. I can hear the sounds of admiration or a kind of like, he's my best friend, I lean on him for everything, you know, the kind of like Instagram sounds, but I'm not getting the sort of texture of how it feels inside this marriage at all. I feel like there are all these rooms with the doors locked in this marriage and I can't see what's happening. So what I wanted was to just, I kind of figured I have a great marriage. I should just be the one to tell everyone the truth, which is that even in a great marriage, you have times when you just aren't communicating that well, or you're annoyed with each other. You have eras where you kind of drift slowly apart and you have to notice and come back together. That was my sort of arrogant view of what I was going to do. And then when I actually started to write the book, I mean, it's not necessarily the healthiest thing to start looking at your marriage and picking things apart. It eventually can be if you stick with it. But at first you just feel like, why am I here? Why are we doing this? This is a joke. You know, like I definitely wanted to question marriage, you know, rhetorically. And then I found myself really questioning it. Not questioning it like, I got to get out of here, I hate my husband, but questioning it at the level of, it's kind of crazy that I'm going to stay with this one person forever. Like, who thought that up? That seems weird. Like, I don't mind the idea of keeping him with me as I do lots of interesting things forever, but should I really only have to be with this one person? Wouldn't it be nicer, in fact, if I could do whatever the hell I want? But also, you know, he could be my sort of roommate husband who is, or husband number one. Maybe I need five husbands. So I started to kind of question. And I also, I mean, legitimately, I'm kind of joking around, but I did look at my actual relationship with my husband and say, how are we connecting enough? You know, do we have enough passion in our lives? And in asking those questions, we did start to connect more and we did find more passion and pull more passion into our lives, but it kind of took a thorough audit to get there. So the process of writing the book was great for us, but yeah, I really wanted to write a book that captured the ambivalence of spending your entire life with someone. And I also wanted to show, instead of just saying in my column, I wanted to show how two people overcome cold feet, overcome a lot of conflict, overcome those times when they're just in a situation where both people just absolutely disagree. And I wanted to show those crisis points and how Bill and I made it through them in slow motion almost. I mean, mm-hmm. the book is kind of a fast-paced book, but when I come to a crisis point, everything slows down. And that's by design. I wanted to show how you can completely be in the worst possible spot and still find your way through and find more love and forgiveness there.
Let's talk about this New York Times excerpt that was published. An excerpt was published called Marriage Requires Amnesia. And as part of the opening, you write, quote, "When encountering my husband, Bill, in our shared habitat, I sometimes experience him as a tangled hill of dirty laundry. Who left this here, I ask myself. And then the laundry gets up to fetch itself a cup of coffee," end quote. This is kind of an adapted section of your book, if I understand correctly. And the blowback to it was kind of interesting. And I guess I'm curious, how did you experience the reaction to this piece?
I knew that there would be some negative reaction. When the New York Times chose this chapter to run, I was a little worried. I thought, like, this is not necessarily a very indicative of the tone of the entire book. This chapter comes 3/4 of the way into the book. We've established that Bill and I are very honest with each other and make fun of each other and trust each other by then. So I knew it was going to be hard for some people to digest it out of context, but I also am just used to making people mad. I mean, when I wrote for Salon, you know, the stuff that I wrote for Salon didn't necessarily fit that neatly into Salon, right? I mean, Salon was a pretty, in the early 2000s, a lot of what was in Salon was a little bit self-serious and somber and self-righteous. I mean, I don't want to insult it all because there are plenty of great people writing for it. Laura Miller, King Kaufman, there are all kinds of great writers there during that time. But I had haters, you know, through the 2000s, through the aughts, right?
So yeah. So you're used to people not liking your stuff.
Yeah.
You have strong opinions on things.
Well, you know, the thing is, you can be used to writing for online audiences and think that you're used to hate mail, but something like 1.5 million people read that excerpt, which is a different scale, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So once you have that many people, that big a sample, and you're writing something that's kind of like, it's not designed to provoke, but it is, it is comedic, right? I mean, it's when I ask the question, do I hate my husband? You know, I'm trying to write something funny. So I say, yeah, sure I do. You know, it's not like I walk around saying to people every day, oh, I hate him. I hate that guy. You know, yeah. my dominant, even the, so now that it's hit the level of, you know, now that it's become like a New York Post headline, right? That says, I don't know if I'm skipping ahead in your questions.
But it's okay. It's okay. Yeah.
I mean, basically, not to spoil the end, right? No spoilers. Yep. But whatever, you don't really look ahead and say, this is how it will get metabolized down mm-hmm. to, you're just a bitch, you know? Like, you don't have that in mind. You're just like, I'm writing something, it's funny, you know? And you give it to someone else and they say, this is hilarious, I love it. I mean, one of the weaknesses of being someone who's 51 years old is, you know,
you have less fucks to give. Like, you're just like, who cares if people don't like it? Yeah.
You're sending it to your friends who have your sense of humor, right? And they're like, this is hilarious. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of fun because you also sort of wake people up who think you're just writing Love Yourself Forever, you know?
Right, right.
Like, plenty of people who knew my writing in the old days has sort of fallen asleep because they're like, you're just telling 20-somethings how to live, like, boring. So being myself completely on the page and having fun and getting weird and being, I mean, I try to do that with Polly, but it's not always possible when you're talking about heavy subjects. So it's kind of like, there are advantages to saying, hey, I'm still an asshole, you know, because some people love that. And just like finding the other assholes is nice. You know, like, oh, mm-hmm. here come the assholes. Awesome. You're back. Like, because you've been talking to really nice people, which is also wonderful. I mean, this is why I created Ask Molly. Polly's evil twin, Molly, has her own newsletter. And I did that because I felt a little bit constricted by Polly's sweetness. And I just wanted a place to put my evil thoughts. So... yeah, I did, you know, I anticipated some negative reaction. The monster that it's grown into has been alarming.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that. Before we get to that, I did want to mention one thing. Kate Harding at Dame Magazine wrote a piece called Have We Forgotten How to Read Critically? I don't know if you read that piece.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's a great piece. But so essentially, just to summarize, if in case it's not clear, people read this article in the New York Times. They're like, Heather Havrilesky hates her husband because she says you hate your husband. But, you know, what they're not grasping, obviously, is that there's like a full context. There's a fuller context. And there's obviously a sardonic attitude behind it. And there's obviously a lot of love there. And it's about capturing these contradictions that are inherent within marriage. In this piece, Kate Harding wrote about the reaction to that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And she writes, quote, today, the author is not dead. Until the author is actually dead. In the meantime, every published piece of writing is treated as the beginning of a conversation, or worse, a workshop piece by some readers, each of whom feels entitled to a bespoke response. What did you mean by that? Is this supposed to be funny? Did you consider X? Why didn't you do this thing the way I would have done it instead? I'm writing an essay on your book from a high school class. Do you have 15 minutes for an interview about the key themes? They tweet these things, they email them, they reply in the comments, they blog about them, and they snitch tag the author. There is no apparent awareness that in writing a piece and publishing it, the author has said what they meant to say and turned the project of thinking about it over to the reader. Today's reader simply will not accept the baton being passed, end quote. I'm curious if that reflects your opinion on the way online discourse is going these days.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, comparing my husband to a heap of laundry, even making that, okay, so that's the headline of my New York Times book review when it went up.
Yes.
Heather Havrilesky compares her husband to a heap of laundry. And so now, you know, hundreds of thousands of readers believe that my book is me comparing my husband to a heap of laundry. Now, when you think about why did I compare my husband to a heap of laundry? Why would I do that to my poor husband? If you think about it as an action, right? Like all I did was, you know, in Defector, Albert Brunecko wrote that I'd written an extremely mean blog about my husband. Again, this is projection. Albert Brunecko wrote an extremely mean blog about my excerpt of my book that is about my marriage. So I did not write an extremely mean blog. I wrote a book and it was excerpted. But you know, when you're a woman and you wrote a book, you're also just some harpy out in the town square screaming about your husband, you know? It's just exactly the same to a lot of people. They're not getting the writing part of it. And when you say that, when you read the heap of laundry part of that, of the book, it functions in the book as an experience that you have living in your house in a marriage where you're just living your life and there's something in the way. And what is it? What could be in the way? Well, it could be a heap of laundry, or it could be your husband. It's the point is, you sometimes have no feelings, right? You sometimes have a void. It's not that you hate the person. You have a void of feeling for this shape that's in front of you. You just want to get on with your day. Which isn't, that's like a familiar and knowable experience that it's hard to put into words without an image attached to it. That's writing. That's crafting, you know, a feeling, putting a feeling on the page. So when someone says to you, why did you do that to your husband? Comparing him to a heap of laundry. Or when someone says, read the room. No one wants to know about, you know, no one wants I hate my marriage humor right now. You know, it's like, I've been working on this very multifaceted book about my marriage for 3 years now. Furthermore, my job is not to read the room and then give the room whatever kind of, the word blowjob comes to mind. But you know, or let's say hand job, that's a little nicer.
Yes. You know, well done. Yes.
Way to back off.
Yes.
Yeah, it's I'm not supposed to just circulate in a room giving hand jobs, you know, like that's a different job than the job that I feel I have. But, you know, through the lens of the way that we metabolize and digest and process cultural artifacts at this moment, everything is kind of boiled down to, did I get off or not? You know, did I get a meal out of it? What did you do for me? You didn't even mention me. You know, I mean, that's a common Twitter response to things. Hold on a second. I didn't see me in this. Where am I? You know, it's like, fuck off. It's not about you. And then the response is, yeah, but you pretended that you were talking about all marriages and you didn't accurately capture my marriage. If you were going to talk about, you shouldn't be talking about all marriages. And then it becomes, well, that's interesting. In the New York Times review, he says, marriage is a secret. The writer says marriage is a secret. And then he says, this author makes all these claims about what a marriage is. She writes, marriage is this and marriage is that. Why do we care what she thinks about marriage? You know, something like that. And it's like, wait a second. Didn't you just say marriage is a secret? So who this? It's more about who's the authority here than it is about what I actually wrote on the page and what value it has. That's kind of the feeling of life right now. It's like, wait a minute, who's the authority? You're not the authority. Stop writing things. And, you know, and then it goes on from there, right? Because it's not just about analyzing text. Eventually, it's about this author isn't an author. This is an offensive wife. You know, we don't need to read the book. We're just going to talk about what we don't like about this wife lady, which, you know, you can't enter into that and win. You can't argue with it. I mean, the triumph of this whole thing for me has been that I've kept myself from, you know, because I love arguing. To keep yourself from debating with people on Twitter is like it should be one of Erikson's developmental stages.
Well, you've hinted at this, right? But essentially, the negative response to the book has metastasized in a rather surprising way. NewYorkPost.com has a headline entitled, "Wife Calls Marriage Insane, Hates Her Husband, Snoring Heap of Meat." In quotes, on your Twitter account, you posted a clip from The View that kind of also, it was similar in tone to that New York Post piece.
There apparently is a new book by a journalist wife and mom who reflects in her on her 16 years of marriage, writing about how she hates her husband, calls him a smelly heap of laundry and a snoring heap of meat, and claims anyone considering getting married is a masochist.
Brian, did your wife write that?
Yet she also calls it divine. Yes, thank you. I actually need to read that. Can you relate to anything she writes here?
You know what? She, we got snippets of this book, and they use the word hate, and she used the word heap a lot. Did you notice that? She calls him a heap of this and a heap of that. But marriage is work. Yeah. So I think her book, she wants to describe to people, like, you fall in love, and you think that that state of bliss, it, there's no way it's going to diminish, right, when you first fall in love?
Bless you.
Yeah, bless you. It does diminish. I mean, the blissful part diminishes. Just like you have a baby and you're in bliss, and then they turn 16 and you're like, the blissful part is diminished. Mm-hmm. So I think she's being real about that, and that's okay.
I think she's being too real about
it. Well, with the hate word, I don't...
She also writes this. She says, it's in... She calls marriage a funny thing, and then she says, it's insane and completely deluded to set out to try to stay with the same person until you're dead. And the madness of the venture creates comedy at every turn, because obviously we fail and disappoint ourselves all the time. I think that's all true, but she wrote it down. And I think she wrote all
these things... Better to keep it quiet.
You know, she wrote all these things down about her spouse in a book, let alone, you know, you don't say things like that, I think, to your life partner.
But the thing I like about it,
I love the idea that her husband stands by this. He's like, he's fine with it. She's selling
books.
Is
he really, though?
Yes. You know,
for
25 years, I've been on the show. Every once in a while, I make a joke about Steve. Like, one time I called him Waze's bitch, for example. Because he does not function in the car without Waze
anymore.
That's
truth-telling, Joanne.
And so people were like, oh, that's not nice. He's like, he thought it was funny. So this man is like my husband, except he's not a heap of laundry. I wouldn't put him there. I wouldn't say he's... What did she call him? A heap of anything?
She calls him a smelly heap of laundry and a snoring heap of meat.
You know, from my perspective, there's actually a couple things at work here, right? One of them is just this notion or driving force in media to be as sensationalistic as possible, right? Heather Havrilesky wrote a book about marriage and its contradictions and its beauty and its flaws and its wonder and the awe of it and all these things. But the thing that's sort of most likely to get rage clicks is that you called your husband a snoring heap of meat. Mm-hmm. And so they'll just take that clip, and that's the thing that's going to get the clicks, I should say. And then separately, there's a thing that you identify in this Twitter thread you wrote about this yesterday about how there's this kind of sexism in it, that like if a man wrote a similar thing about marriage being challenging, they would be treated much differently. What's your perspective on that?
So there are two layers of it. I mean, once you throw in the, this wouldn't happen to a man thing, then my mind goes in that direction. But there's also the heap of this, heap of that, because on the View, what they did was they said, they showed a picture of me and my husband behind them. And then they said, a wife, mother, and journalist has written a book about how she hates her husband. And how he's a snoring heap of, she calls him a snoring heap of meat. Oh, thank God, why did she? Who is this? And so that, and then, you know, the conversation, it sort of rolls around in, she calls him a heap of this and a heap of that. And they just keep circling heap, the heap, and the he's smelly. She said he was smelly too. Well, that's, I mean, that's, and someone says, one of them says, that's true, but she wrote it down. Like, the crime was that I wrote it down. You know, it might be true that men are smelly, okay? But, and then someone says, well, what about her husband apparently doesn't even mind. He doesn't mind her writing this stuff. And someone says, well, he's lying then. He's lying. I mean, what do you think the people at his work are saying about this? Even if he thinks he doesn't mind, he's going into work and they're ribbing him and giving him a hard time, and he doesn't like that. He's humiliated. You know, it's like they're writing a story, right? And mm-hmm. it's based on, they said they had a snippet. What they had was one tiny snippet of my book that was originally the excerpt. Like, there was a snippet of the excerpt. And then they had the New York Post article, which was based on a Daily Mail article, which was based on a Times UK article, which was an interview with me. And they were calling things from this interview, things from a conversation that was kind of free and fun, they were calling those snippets too. So they were saying, she says marriage is insane, you know? And it's like, I'm having a conversation with someone, a reporter, where I'm saying, if you really think about it, staying with the same person until you're dead, you know, just objectively, that sounds insane if you really think about it, you know, when you step back for a second. But the fact that it condenses so nicely down to wife hates husband, snoring heap of meat, 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 heap, 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 you know, it's amazing. It's amazing to see. It's also crazy that you could do a whole spot and not mention my book's title or my name. Now, if David Sedaris is on, now granted, David Sedaris is worldwide famous, crazy famous, and I love him. Has anyone ever said husband calls husband, you know, inattentive or, you know, aloof or, you know, any of the things that he's called Hugh over the years?
It's because you violated some kind of unspoken taboo.
Don't do things to men is the taboo. Don't hurt man feelings. Man feelings matter most. I mean, the review in the New York Times began with my husband's feelings, shifted to a few things, went back to my husband's feelings, and then ended on my husband's feelings. So you'd think that my memoir, the main thing about my memoir that matters is how my husband feels about it. And that's the conversation that The View had too. You know, the misogyny of it is inescapable. It's when the New York Times assigned my book to a man, I've had a few things to say about it. I mean, it bothered me. It's not just any man either. There are men that I'd happily give to review. I love Christian Lorentzen. Give him my book, you know? Would he give me a bad review? I'd respect it if he didn't like my marriage memoir. Give it to a person who can read a woman's memoir and treat it respectfully. I don't feel that that's how this review treated my memoir. And my memoir is, this book is good. It's very, you know, this is my fourth book. I don't know, whatever. But then on top of that, the fact that, you know, is there any writer who has, I don't know, it's hard to pick someone who's like, okay, who's around my level of experience, same number of books, let's say, mostly well-reviewed. I mean, I can't even think of anyone because you know what? People who write at my level, who are men, who have been in this business writing shit every day for 26 years, they're fucking famous. They're famous. Chuck Klosterman, worldwide fame. I'm not saying that I'm as good as anybody else at all. But you know what? It's not possible to even compare because we live in different worlds. We absolutely get treated in different ways. It's ludicrous how women get treated by our culture. It's absolutely not even, it doesn't even get under my, I swear to Christ, it doesn't even get under my skin anymore. This thing got under my skin because I was sitting on the couch, I got the clip, and I'm sitting with my daughters and I'm like, and they're like, what are you looking at? And I'm like, you don't need to see this. And like, they heard the first part of it. And I was like, I feel like this is just going to upset you. And they're like, no, I want to see the whole thing. And you know, it's like at the end of it, they're like, what? They not read your book and then say wife hates husband. And that's all. Like, that's the cringiest thing I've ever seen. They're just grossed out by how sexist the culture is. And it's not like I point it out to them constantly. I just am who I am. Like, they just live in a house with two parents who, you know, it's an egalitarian marriage. We're equals. And so the world seems completely warped and insane to them everywhere they go, which is how it should seem because it is warped and insane. Anyway, you're really letting me stomp, stomp, stomp.
It's all good. It's all good. I mean, I think that, you know, your Twitter thread pointed out a number of double standards. And the thing that's most interesting to me is this idea that society puts out, that pop culture puts out, the way that it's talked about, that, you know, marriage, our concept of marriage often ends at the wedding, right? And like, as you said, when we started, you know, there are not that many books about marriage itself. There are a lot of books about love and falling in love. But like, I think one of the things your book does is it says the things that you're not supposed to say. And that's what has gotten a lot of people upset. Even in that View clip, you can tell people are like quite conflicted about whether or not what you're saying is actually accurate, you know? Mm-hmm. So
I have to say, though, that I don't completely understand why we're not supposed to say anything about marriage. I mean, I understand being paranoid that other people will think your marriage is bad if you say anything negative. I mean, that's a cultural thing that just is in action.
Yeah. But did you see The Lost Daughter, that movie, the Maggie Gyllenhaal movie, by any chance?
Oh, no.
It's a fascinating movie. It's on Netflix. And it's essentially about this woman who has difficulty being a mom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she finds like the challenges of motherhood to be virtually insurmountable. And I think one of the reasons people said it was like a very brave film, and you know, I agree with that assessment, is that like there's stuff about like there's stuff in society that you're not supposed to tell people or let people know is difficult. And one of those things is being a mom, and like a lot of pressure on moms to like do it all. And I think probably being a wife or being a husband probably falls into that category. Certainly, yeah, being a wife more than being a husband, you know?
You're probably right. And it is true that when it comes to child-related things, I am much more, like I said before, discreet and careful. And also,
right.
If I have bad moments as a mother, I'm not anxious to write about them as much as I am about my marriage. So I definitely have an affinity for writing about love relationships that I do not have for writing about failing. I mean, there are parts of the book, obviously you've read it, that where I'm saying I'm bad at this mom thing. But I think writing something like, I would prefer not to be in this role, I don't think that I would ever go there. But it's also because I don't feel that way personally. Like I don't struggle with that. So it's not as interesting to me to write about it. You know, it's not just that it feels dangerous. It's also just, well, I mean, I can't really relate to wanting to walk away from my kids at all. I don't understand it. So I should see that movie.
Yeah, The Lost Daughter. It's very good. So last question, you know, you've now gotten the book out there. You've seen the reaction to the book. Have you learned anything in terms of like, you know, it seems like it's reinforced things you already understood about how our society treats women and marriage. But is there anything you do differently, or has it sharpened your resolve? Like, I guess I'm curious, like what your takeaways are from how the book is being received right now.
Well, I mean, two different things. One is probably more personal, and one is three things. Oh, see, this is where I go wrong. first of all, it's made my marriage better to write this book, just without a doubt. And also I feel so proud of the book, so I don't mind running around bragging about it. And I also don't mind it when people malign it that much. I mean, it's kind of been, I make it sound like I'm pissed off, and I'm pissed off about the state of the culture kind of, but I'm not necessarily that pissed off about where my experience with this so far, because, you know, I'm lucky to have any press at all, and I'm getting press, and it's great. And I'm hoping that it'll translate to the book actually selling. There's no guarantee of that. And it doesn't seem like right now, like it's just, you know, can't keep it on the shelves. Books are really hard to sell. But the whole point of this book was to make our talk around marriage more humane and less damning to the people who can't figure it out yet or get divorced or are single. I mean, there's a way that our talk about all relationships and all realities is so unforgiving and so merciless. And so by talking about the things that are embarrassing, particularly, listen, writing about things that are embarrassing and doing it in a funny way and making it entertaining, that's the only way to do it as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's not like I'm saying, I want 15,000 people to be writing modern loves about their, you know, broken marriages right now. I want to read all of them. You know, I'm not that interested in all of the stories, but if you're going to do it well, God damn it, amazing. Like, let me have it. I'll eat that up. So the point is that when we create these stories that are very true and very real, and we put them out into the world, it makes people feel better about where they are and the fact that you cannot live up to our society's insane expectations about what a woman should be, just for example. So that feels, it just feels like it reinforces my idea that our culture is just so inhumane, and good stories about how it really feels to be alive are good for us. They're good for us, and they're good for us as a group, and they're also good for us individually. I mean, it's soothing to read something like David Sedaris, who outlines his flaws in such detail and says, "I don't know what the hell I'm doing," over and over again. It's delicious. And then professionally, I kind of feel like, I don't know, I've always been conflicted about promoting myself. I mean, it probably doesn't show. I probably just seem like a big fucking show off everywhere I go, but I am conflicted. And I don't want to be gross and just sell, read this, read that. But I feel like I've reached a point where I'm like, listen, if The View's going to talk about me without using my goddamn name, they're going to hear from me about it. You know, like, and the thing is, you, in order to say that, you also have to be willing to get on a plane and be on The View, which, by the way, I was not 100% not willing to do that in my heart of hearts, like even a year ago. And now I'm like, have me on. I want to talk to you, Joy. And Whoopi, you know, and it's like, it's hard to be a writer and also be a person who's willing to get on a plane. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just those two, they're competing impulses. So for me professionally at this moment, and as a person also, and just as a woman, I just feel like, damn it, I don't care what kind of trouble I'll start. Just, I'm going out there and I'm going to do what it takes to say what I want to say, you know, and I'm going to write the things that I trust that I think are worthwhile. And I'm not going to wait for other people to give me the cue that it's cool or that, you know, what I'm doing is good or bad. I don't need to read the room anymore. I'm going to create what I want to create and trust my instincts. I've kind of been doing that sort of for my whole career, but there are always these layers of, I don't know, is this dumb? So, yeah, I'm done with that. At least today, I feel like I am.
Well, Heather Havrileski writes the Ask Polly advice column on Substack. She's the author of other books, including How to Be a Person in the World and What If This Were Enough. Her newest book, Foreverland, on the Divine Tedium of Marriage, can be found wherever books are sold. Heather Havrileski, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks, David. I thank you for letting me scream and pound the table.
Welcome to Weekly Recommendations, the part of the show each week where we recommend something we've been watching, drinking, reading, listening to, etc. This week, I want to recommend All of Us Are Dead, which is a South Korean horror show on Netflix. 12 episodes long, and I've plugged it a couple times on various podcasts and on social media, but I just think it's really great. It's a combination between Battle Royale and Train to Busan with a heavy dose of teen drama thrown in there. I just think it's a big accomplishment. It's super ambitious. There's really wild set pieces with hundreds of extras. If you are into horror, and in particular South Korean horror, I think you're really going to enjoy All of Us Are Dead, which again is streaming right now on Netflix. I also asked Heather Havrileski what she wanted to recommend. Here's what she had to say.
I've been listening to Hop Along. Do you know that band?
Mm-mm.
It's great. Female singer. Hop Along. Oh, yeah. And Torres is amazing.
Any
have you ever
specific...
heard Torres?
No,
it's
I haven't.
It's sort of like, oh, well, my kids would just, if I played either one, that I played Hop Along for them. They're like, indie. Like, they just write it off as indie. It's like a sound that sounds not very interesting to them. They listen to, like, sort of pop and K-pop. But they listen to some things that they consider emo, which is completely different than what we used to call emo. But Hop Along and Torres are both kind of, they're just, the sound is sort of almost 90s indie sound, I guess. I don't know. But they're young. So it's weird. It's good. It's good stuff.
That's going to do it for us today on Culturally Relevant. Thank you so much for listening. Find more episodes of the podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. This podcast was powered by Simplecast. Check out Simplecast.com for a great podcast management and analytics solution. And the podcast was edited and produced by me, David Chen. Appreciate you stopping by. We'll see you later.